This is Michael Conforti, September 27th, 2012. The Spiritual Mandates of an Inspired Life. This was recorded on DVD, and it did have a few images, and the DVD is in the library at the Jung Society.
Well, greetings to everyone coming out on this another beautiful Seattle summer day. We're very, very happy to have Dr. Michael Conforti again with us. Dr. Conforti's been here before, and we're very, very happy to have him come back. So I'd like to have Dr. Conforti come up and speak to us. Thank you.
For a lot of reasons, Seattle is one of my favorite places to come to. And I don't know, the people, the environment. It's not raining today, which I loved. I love that. Thank you for the wonderful weather. But there's a spirit out here I really like. And I found out, interesting story, when my family came, part of my family from Calabria. Now, I don't know why I had the Pacific Northwest for 20 years of my life, right? Portland and here. I found out a number of years ago that when my family came from Calabria, part of them settled in New York, the other part up in Seattle. Is that wild? So somewhere around here, there are Confortis and Cristos. That's the other last name we had. C-R-I-S-T-O. Well, okay, what we're going to talk about tonight is something I've been looking at for a number of years, which is the story of Abraham and Isaac. And like for like a lot of people, I've struggled with it. And it never settled, like a meal that doesn't, you can't digest it and you don't feel right afterwards. And I've spent quite a few years really beginning to study this from the tradition of Christianity, Judaism, and also as a clinician. I've been a clinician for 30 years. I love my clinical work. And I realize one of the issues that I hope we're going to address tonight well is what makes it so difficult for us to live an inspired life. Now, none of us are pie in the sky people, I hope, even though you talked about the end of time. After the end of time workshops, then you're going to do denial workshops. You know, we got to talk about denial and have a lot of parties after those workshops. But there are, I think, some archetypal reasons why we don't submit to something greater than ourselves. That's part of what this talk is about tonight, why we don't do it. And I think in the same way we have inherited DNA structures and morphogenetic structures and morphological structures, and we know we have archetypal inheritances, I think we've also inherited a terror of submission and supplication to something greater. That's what the theme is about. And I also would imagine everybody has had moments in your life where you touch something divine, where you know what it's like, whether it's reading a book, playing with your kids, doing sculpting, you know, whatever your thing is, doing books, making paper, and you know you're with something bigger than yourself. One of the things for me is writing. I love it. And I know I'm with whatever you want to call it, God, with the self. And getting to it is a challenge. I mean, aside from a busy schedule, when you look at your desk, you think, well, you got to clean your desk before you write. And then after you clean your desk, that's about 2 hours, then you see you should sand it down. You sand it down because it should be sanded. Then you got to... Then you got to put the nice oil on, and that takes like 3 days to dry. And then when it's finished, might as well do the floor, you know. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And you say, "But I really wanted to write." And you ask, "Okay, what is it?" In psychology, we have fear of success. Well, that's a pretty deep one. That goes really far. Fear of success. We're just addicted to trauma. That's true in a lot of ways. But I think there's another part of the story, which is what I've been studying now for about 5 years. And a couple of ways to begin this. One is by one of my favorite authors. Some of you know Rabbi Heschel. Abraham Heschel. And in the introduction written by his daughter, who I happen to know, I met her many years ago. She's a professor at Dartmouth. It's called I Ask for Wonder. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, sacred little book. She puts this little piece here on page in the intro. She writes, 10 days before his death, Heschel had taped a television interview for NBC and was asked by the interviewer at the close of the program if he had a special message for young people. He nodded his head and seemed to turn to the future he would never see. And he said, "Know that every deed counts, that every word is power. Above all, remember that you must build your life as if it were a work of art, Isn't it beautiful? And his work is all about the ineffable, all about the sense of transcendence. And we all pray, we do things, we do analysis, we put a lot of money out, we live, hopefully, you know, pretty good lives. But there's something about that experience of transcendence that is difficult to touch. And the way we're going to go about this today is through a series of questions. And some of you know that Elie Wiesel, who's many people say is one of the greatest living sages of our time, he writes in his autobiography, he said, as a child, when he came back from his religious lessons, his parents never asked him what he learned. All the people said, what'd you learn today? What parable? What commandment? What'd you study? He said his parents would ask him, what questions did you ask? And I love that. And you find a lot of the great writers and thinkers and artists ask questions. And the two questions tonight are, number one, which I just addressed, which is, what are we so afraid of in submitting and supplicating ourselves to what is greater, to God or to self? Second question, kind of tough one, what fuels our collective sense of bloodlust, which we've had since the beginning of time? I wish it wasn't true. Bloodlust from the religious crusades to what goes on in the Middle East, what goes on in our country, on and on. So many things have been done in the name of God. And I remember writing a few pieces about this, in the name of God. And I just went off and I wrote like hours about it. And we're going to approach this by addressing a number of stories tonight. One big one is we're going to look at the Akedah, the story of Isaac and Abraham. Because that's, I mean, if you think about it, Abraham is a pretty big player for all of us. I mean, he's like number one for the Jews and the Christians. And there's a curve in that story that it's important for us to address. Yeah, next, we're going to address the story of the book of Tobit in the Bible, in one of the apocryphal books, the story of Tobit and Sarah. Then we're going to switch it from those stories to what I'm calling peering beyond the veil, which is those moments of transcendence that we have. And we're going to do it by looking at two stories. One, a clinical vignette, a woman that she believes she made a sacrifice, but it wasn't a sacrifice. And then a story of just wonderful sacrifice and redemption, which is a story of, I don't know if I pronounced it correctly, Lima Bala, Bali? Yeah. The story of this woman in Africa that really created a whole liberation movement, and she stopped the warlords from killing thousands and thousands of people. She really single-handedly did this. So this is our task. It's a big task, like an hour, an hour and a half. So we're going to go for about an hour-ish, take a break. Apparently that's your tradition here, take a break, and then some questions. Let's begin with the story of Abraham and Isaac. Okay, and we're going to ground, as I say, I'm going to create the biblical archetypal story, then I'm going to ground it in our life and real life. We think we all know a fair amount about the story. We all hear about it, we study it, we read it, and it's a story where God came down to Abraham and said, you know, give up your only begotten son to prove your love for me. Okay, give up what you most love, and then I will reward you with all the wonderful things in life. And he says, well, God's asking this of me, you know, who am I to say no? An interesting related piece. We had Deb, when you were in Portland a couple of years ago, we did the whole piece on sacrifice. And we had a wonderful speaker named Carol Delaney, who wrote a book, The Trial of Abraham on Trial. It's a great book. It's a feminist approach to the Abraham story. By the way, Sarah was never asked if they could sacrifice the kid. So anyway, she writes in the opening of the book, she said there was a real-life story that just happened in L.A., I think it was L.A., where a man had these visions. And in the visions, God came to him and said, take your daughter up to the mountain, the way Abraham took Isaac to Mount Moriah, and sacrifice your daughter, if you love me. And you know, he thought he was going crazy. These are psychotic thoughts, right? They kept on coming, and they got stronger and stronger and stronger. And he finally, one day, early morning, like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, when his wife was still asleep, he took his daughter up to the mountain, and he sacrificed her for God. And when the police found him, they brought him to court, and you know, they struggled. And Carol Delaney, it's a wonderful book. She writes about, she said, the courts and the lawyers didn't know what to do with him because, now you see where we're going with it? Say, how can we put this guy in jail and find him guilty if he's doing God's work? If they were to find him guilty, you realize you got to go back and review how many thousands of years of biblical history? So eventually they did say he was psychotic and he was insane and put him in a mental hospital and all this, but they did struggle for a while. Okay, so we know the story, that if you love me, you sacrifice what you most love, give up your child, and then come to God. Well, I've been reading Elie Wiesel's work for about 10 years now. And I have not found anyone with the brilliance and the profundity that this man has in the way he looks at biblical tales, the way he looks at life, the way he looks at suffering, and the way he looks at redemption. So I got a gift a number of years ago, and it was a gift of a series of lectures he gave at Boston University. And one of them happened to be on the Binding of Isaac. And it was really a wonderful tape. And he asked a question at the beginning of it, a question that made me ashamed that I never thought of the question. He said, do we ever wonder why God chose Abraham for this task? I said, I never thought about it. You know, why would I even ask that question? He said, well, it's a pretty important question. Of all the figures around, why ask him? And also, is it even accurate, the story, when God says, take your only begotten son and sacrifice? Elie Wiesel goes on and gives us what I refer to in my notes, the backstory of the Abraham tale. He reminds us that Abraham and Sarah were living together for many years in marital whatever they had. I think they were like 450 years old. They just had a birthday. If she was 450, he was like 420. And they wanted to make a baby. And they felt for different reasons, maybe she was too old and God wouldn't bless them with a child. And she says, eventually, my good husband, I know you want a child. Why don't you have a child with Hagar, the slave girl? And he said, you mean that beautiful young girl? And but my wife, you're 450 years old, and together we make babies. You really want me to do this? And he's like thanking God, you know, privately. And she says, yes, I want you to do this. Because I love you as my husband. I will make this sacrifice for you. It's interesting, if you do some research on the story, you find out what Abraham did with this request. He went and he prayed. And he asked God, he said, God, you can imagine Joe Pesci doing the scene or Robert De Niro. Okay. What do I do with this request? Do I really make a baby with the slave girl? But this is my wife. Isn't this being... I'm being disloyal. This is terrible. This is adultery. And God said, so be it. It should be. Do as Sarah said. So he does. He makes a baby with her and probably eyes closed and everything. But he did it. And they have a child named Ishmael. And everything went well for a while, and suddenly, somehow, interesting part of the story, Sarah gets pregnant. And they have a son called Isaac. And they were raising these two children together for a while, until the time of the bris, the circumcision. That's when Sarah said, remember that thing I said to you a while ago? I don't like it anymore. I don't like the fact there's this other woman in the picture. She kind of lives. You have another wife and another family. Now, sidebar, think of this in a lot of us, and people that have, what are they called, broke with the marriages? Blended families. This is part of the archetype of blended families, one of the reasons why it's such a struggle. So she says, I don't like this anymore. I've changed my mind, and we are to raise Isaac. Isaac is to be the heir apparent of everything that you have and we have together, my dear husband. Okay, now, what is it you want me to do? Get rid of the two of them. And she's in the stories, it says she knows she's asking something unimaginable because he loves his son. He loves his child. But she feels like she has to ask. And what does he do? What does he do? He prays. And he says, God, okay, look, you came through once for me when I asked you the question, what do I do about, do I make a baby with this other woman here? What do I do now? Do I really banish it into the will? And she said, go to the worst of the worst. Like, go to Antarctica, you know, the equivalent of Antarctica, the most barren lands imaginable, wild and barren. He got on his knees and prayed to God. And he said, well, what do I do? And God said, you must listen to your wife. None of that's the wife's anima pretending to be God in the story. I'm not sure who this really is saying, which is a really very important question, in all honesty, to the story. Who is this God? What is it we attribute as God and self in this tale? Which is really important for all of us to be addressing. What do we totemize as the supreme of the supreme, the entire, the capo di capo, the head of the heads, okay, the boss of the boss? So he does it. He says, we are to go out, my mistress, whatever you called her, pack up your belongings and we're going to go. Where are we going? I can't talk about it. Okay, since you're the man and the father, we're going to go. And they go out into the wilderness and they walk and walk and walk and it's getting worse and worse. And she says, where are we going? And he won't talk. He says, aren't you going to respond to me, Abraham? He said, I'm doing God's work. She says at that point, it's interesting how often God is invoked in these stories. She says, does Allah know I'm here? He said, yes. He said, then we will be safe. Now you can leave us. If you need to, you have to do this, you do it, but at least I know now we will be safe and my son will have a future. So they go off. And years later, we come, as though we open the book again on Abraham. And we learn that God comes to him one night, kind of knocking. He says, now it's time that you give up your only begotten son and go to Mount Moriah and sacrifice him. And Abraham says, yes, I will do that, my God, because I love you so much. You have to prove you love me. And he's packing his belongings and packing the stuff and getting the knife sharpened and everything, and he's doing it. He's doing what God asked him to do. Elie Wiesel says, do you realize when God said, this take your only begotten son, it wasn't true? There was another son. Now, let me give you an interesting sidebar. I was in analysis with somebody in New York for about 6 years. I think it was my third analysis. We have to do a lot of analysis when you're trained to be an analyst. Anyway, he had pictures of his new wife and his little baby on the mantle. Now, I'm coming off the streets of Brooklyn, and I didn't have a lot of tack, a lot of coot. They say coot? They say coot. And I said, what the hell is this? Who is this? Oh, it's my wife and kid. He said, no, it's not. You got another wife and kids. Where's your other family? I said, you're lying, aren't you? You want all your patients to believe you have just this one little baby? You got three other kids around the marriage. Why would you do this? And I remember my psyche landed on this, obviously for another reason, my own family and my father and all that stuff. But it landed on this. You can't hear? It landed on this story saying, why would he make believe this is his only kid? It wasn't. So Wiesel reminds us that there's something really askew in this story from the beginning here because this is not his only son. So what happens is there's a very interesting telling of the story by a great Hasidic master named Woody Allen. You know Woody Allen? And Woody Allen does a great take on the Abraham Isaac story. And he says, well, God came in and he said, look, you get your kid out and all this. And so here's Isaac in his underwear saying, Dad, where are we going? He said, we got to go up to the mountain and we got to do something. He said, Dad, it's the middle of the night. Where are we going? He said, I got to do God's work. He said, the middle of the night, we got to do it. Anyway, they go up and the terrible things that happen and the slaughter. And then Abraham says, God, why would you ask me to do this? And Woody Allen's edition says, I was only kidding. I was only kidding. He said, why would you kid? He said, do you listen to anybody with a booming voice? Like, So Woody Allen adds this little piece of levity to it to kind of wake us up with the story. So we have a sacrifice, right? The sacrifice of the Son to prove your love for God, and the rewards. We know all the rewards that came as a result of this story. Maimonides, one of the great scholars and great spiritual teachers, said sacrifice should be a profound act of giving, an act of reverence. It should be giving what is so personal and deep in your psyche. You can't ask anybody to carry your sacrifice. And in many ways, if you start seeing where I'm going with this, or if I'm being clear in how I'm presenting this, what we have here is a certain distortion of an archetype of sacrifice. Sacrifice is an archetype. Why we all pay for therapy, we whatever we want in life, we have to, you save money to buy this, and you save money for that trip, and you save over years, whatever, and whatever we want in life. You say, well, I really want to finish this book, I want to do this piece of work, I want to do this piece of art, and you make sacrifices to make it happen. Sacrifice is giving something of immense value in your own psychic life. Part of the distortion for us of getting to transcendence is, I think, an ongoing archetypal confusion with sacrifice and suffering. So they go up to the mountain and they're climbing up, and it's very interesting. If you read some of the more secret books of the Bible and some of the secret Jewish books, they say, well, as they're climbing up, this old man, you know, with the cane, he comes walking up and said, where are you going, sir? He said, I'm going up the mountain. He said, you're not going up there. You're going to do a sacrifice. I don't see a ram. I don't see any animal here. He said, God will provide. He said, no, don't do it. This is a devil. It's so interesting. This was the devil coming, dressed as an old man, warning them not to do it. So he didn't get anywhere with it, right? Then suddenly there's a young man comes up to Isaac. He said, Isaac, what are you doing? He said, well, my father. And he said, don't do it. Don't do it. And it's so interesting that the voice of reason comes from the so-called devil in this story, which is an incredible piece of information with this. So they go up, and the rest is kind of history. He goes up, and he's ready to do the sacrifice. Until what happens? Can we get the image of Rembrandt's image, please?
And can you see it from the back? You get the picture here.
That he's doing what he believes is the most sacred act. He's doing God's work. He's making the ultimate sacrifice. And you know the other thing is, we all say to ourselves, this is the right story. I mean, can I ask, honestly, how many people have never questioned this? And I'll put my hand up, too recent, I never questioned. How many people never really questioned if this was the way to ultimate divinity and all that? Yeah. Well, most of you are a lot more advanced than we are then. Only about 5 people raised their hand. I never did. I grew up as Roman Catholic, Italian Roman Catholic. We said, yeah, we want to be like Abraham. You know, we want to be like him. We never questioned it. He went up. Now, thank God there was suddenly the appearance of what? The angel. Now, angels, actually, Dr. Yoram Kaufman, a wonderful Jungian analyst that passed away a couple years ago, wrote about the angel. And he said, the angel is the articulator of archetypal fields. The angel of birth, Gabriel, coming at birth. The angel of death, the angel of midlife, the angel on top of a lecture hall, the angel on top of opera houses. And the angel is the one that says to you, this is what happens in midlife. This is what happens when, like what Gabriel said to Mary, she said, here's what's going to happen and here's your life and you're the only one. And it's a beautiful articulation. Thank God the angel came. The angel brought the gift of reason to this story. Now, as we're going to go on with this talk tonight, there are many versions of these so-called sacrifices. We have the story of war. We're going to sacrifice our young, okay? Now, my stepson, he just got home today from 9 months of boot camp. His mom is going nuts. Her heart's just ripped open with this. Now, I'm not saying bad things about war, but you think about what can happen to how many poor kids. But we're going to send our kids, we're going to sacrifice our kids for the greater good. And, you know, on one hand, for real war and whatever, sometimes we have to do it. It's part of life. but it's bantered about so easily. We'll sacrifice them. I supervised a case many years ago where it was a story of a mafia family down south, a real-life mafia family. And the father said to the daughter, "You have to perjure yourself to save the family. I don't care what happens to you, you're saving the family. You go to jail, doesn't matter." Sacrifice. We have the story of Jephthah. Some of you know the story of Jephthah and his daughter. The story of Agamemnon and his daughter. All these sacrifices we make. And as you're going to hear the case I get to a little bit later tonight, the woman who sacrificed her kids for her marriage and she gave her children away. There are many things we do. And what I'm teasing out of this story is there's a huge difference between sacrifice and slaughter. There's a main difference between a genuine, profound spiritual act of sacrifice and what is, you give me a word, what is what? What is an abuse? There's a difference. And my point that I'm getting, part of the thesis here, is that I think this is one of the reasons why we are terrified to submit to something greater than ourselves. Because if you look at our history, many of the acts of supplication to something divine, when we give ourselves over to God, you give ourselves over to psyche, give ourselves over to self, in almost all these stories we have, supplication and submission is married to predatory acts. The predator has to find their prey, and the prey better try to kill before the predator gets them. It's seeped in this tradition. And this is why it begins to make us ask ourselves, are we sacrificing Isaac rather than doing our own work or not? Now, as we begin to move on to the next part of the story, when we begin to get a feel for whether you agree, and at least you can see where I'm going with this, what moments of real transcendence look like, where there is a sacrifice. All of us, I think, want to get to a point in life when we're doing the work we're meant to do. That's why I love that piece that Heschel said, that look at every day as a work of art. Look at your life as a work of art. And I'm no different from any of us. I struggle. We all struggle with it. And I've sanded that desk down 30 times, you know. That's why the new book isn't finished. We all struggle. But I think I'm getting a beat on what it's like. The other thing is, when we can begin to look at what are the false sacrifices, we open up to what is real transcendence. And I want to show a little clip of a experience of an angel. Because in many ways, this lecture could also be entitled Angels and Redemption. This is an incredible little video clip where you're going to see an angel in transcendence take over an individual's life. Okay? Does anybody know the story of Paul Potts? Okay, a lot of you don't. Okay, you're going to watch this.
But for the next contestant, the world of showbiz seems a million miles away.
It's Paul, a mobile phone salesman from South Wales.
By day, I sell mobile phones. My dream is to spend my life doing what I feel that I was born to do.
Paul, what are you here for today, Paul?
To sing opera. I've always wanted to sing as a career. Confidence has always been sort of like a difficult thing for me. I've always found it a little bit difficult to be completely confident in myself.
Okay, ready when you are.
Dorma, So you work at Carphone Warehouse. And you did that. I wasn't expecting that.
No, neither was I.
This was a complete breath of fresh air. I thought you were absolutely fantastic.
You have an incredible voice. I think if you keep singing like that, you are going to be one of the favourites to win this whole competition.
I think that we've got a case of a little lump of coal here that is going to turn into a diamond.
Okay, moment of truth, young man. Piers.
Absolutely yes.
Amanda?
Yes.
Paul, you are through to the next round.
Congratulations.
I mean, what you see in this picture is transcendence. This is sacrifice. This is a man that has dedicated his entire life to this work. And whether it's a piece of dance, whether it's a class, whether it's music, you know when you're in the presence of something great and when you're not. And part of it is this sense of opening to something bigger. And the point that a lot of this is organized around is we were taught kind of a lesson that's not a good one. That we get to this point through suffering and struggles and acts and predatory acts. Now, Elie Wiesel went on to talk about this thing about suffering and religion, and he writes, it's a wonderful little book called Evil and Exile. Actually, another one of his little profound books. And he writes, referring to a book, and they say, they're talking about the Holocaust. And they write in a book, wouldn't you say that God abandoned men? And one of the figures in the book says, no. The pain is so unendurable that I can hear it only if I see in it the majesty and compassion of the suffering Messiah. Wiesel goes on. I mean, this is our story. We find ways to make sense of this and justify it. And Wiesel goes on to say, but not even the Messiah could change the fact that 6 million Jews and 18 million people in all were slaughtered in the Holocaust. So even the coming of the Messiah would not necessarily offer an answer to the enormous and unjustifiable suffering. And he goes on, suffering for others, even for God, is a questionable concept, is a questionable theology. A theology of suffering, he says, the very formulation implies a theology of suffering, and to make a theology out of suffering borders on justifying it. Suffer for God would be to claim a justification and self and religious significance for the suffering men have inflicted upon each other. It is much simpler. We do not know the answer, but the moment we turn suffering into an answer, we thereby justify their suffering by ascribing a meaning to it. And that would be to betray both the response and the suffering and the sufferer. And, you know, I think we live with this. You know, I go to Italy a couple of times every year to teach, and, you know, I love going to the cathedrals. I mean, how many of the images are... I remember one little church in the middle of nowhere of St. Agnes with hundreds of arrows in every part of a body. The image of all people that are Christian, of the suffering Christ on the cross, was, as children we see it. And this becomes the paradigm of sacrifice. Sacrifice is a very different experience. Sacrifice is having a sense of what is transcendent in your life, what your gift is, what your destiny is. And having the courage to dedicate your life to it. It's not about asking anybody to carry your story. And all of us in different ways, we do our Isaac sacrifice. It's one of the ways of framing, where have I made my so-called Isaac sacrifice? Where I'm asking somebody to carry it. And I said, the Bible is replete, mythology is replete with stories where you carry it, I'll sacrifice you to get to God. Now, where does redemption enter this picture? Redemption comes in when one understands no one else can ever carry our story. Now, it's interesting. François Mitterrand, the former prime minister of France, was a brilliant theologian. And he wrote in one of his books, he said, what would have happened to humanity, to Christian humanity, to Christians, if we never had a redeemer? What does it do to us? What does it do to the archetypal structure of our lives, the archetypal underpinnings of our life, if we didn't have a redeemer? I grew up in a way, I grew up in Brooklyn, like I said, a big Italian family, and one of the nice things we always had was you knew no matter what happened, there was somebody to bail you out. There's always some uncle who you didn't see too often because they only came around special time. But you knew you can call him. And I've raised my son this way, where I have the whole neighborhood. We get together for big Christmas dinners, 50, 60 people. And I go, give my little talk, and I say, I want my son to know that there's people that can look after him in case of something. God forbid he needs somebody, he can reach out to you for help and provide your compassion to someone in need. It's a wonderful thing. That's different, though, from asking somebody else to carry your destiny, to carry your story of how you want to get to God, get to self, get to the transcendence. And we begin to see stories where it begins to turn, where the stories of asking others to carry our sacrifice to where we do it ourselves. And there are one story in the Bible that's really powerful, and then we're going to get to current life in a minute, is the story of Tobit. It's in one of the apocryphal books in the Catholic Bible. And it's the story of an old man, Tobit, who's hitting the end of his life. He's getting more ill and more disabilities. He's angry at God. And the other side of the story is Sarah. And Sarah has been engaged three times. She engaged to be married on the wedding night of seven wedding nights. Some of you know the story. On each of the seven wedding nights, the husband mysteriously died. I think it's a pattern. but then again, I see patterns everywhere. I go, I think there's a story there. I think the father may be behind it, you know? But anyway, so, you can't hear? Yeah, I know. When I move away, he said, my guy who's doing all the technology said, I know you stand very still when you talk. I said, who are you talking to? So I'm sorry. I'm trying to do my best to stay here. Anyway, so we got Sarah on one hand that had seven marriage nights end with the guy died. The old man, Tobit, it's the aging masculine, the outdated masculine attitude. And his story is, he says, God, I've done so much to show I'm a good man. I do double tithing every year. I bury all the people on the road I see. I'm the most pious of the pious. And in some of the commentaries of the story say, yeah, you're guilty of pride. You know, and you don't do acts of charity to get something out of it. So, and it also interesting is he's going blind. He's gone blind in the story because apparently the sparrows drop their fecal matter in his eyes. And what we learn from mythology, the sparrows are the birds of love. So he's blinded by, he couldn't get to Eros, which is part of where I'm going in the story. He couldn't get to Eros. So anyway, the father says, I want you to go to Medea. I want you to go meet Sarah, meet the family, and all this. It's interesting. It's a rough terrain to get there. And he says, you have to get a guide. God comes in here. Not the God that asks for these barbaric sacrifices or slaughters. God comes in and he says to the angel Raphael, I want you to accompany this man. I want you to teach him how to get to Sarah, to a woman that couldn't ever experience love, a woman who despaired of love, who despaired that Eros and connection would never be hers to touch in life. She would never know the joy of having a partner that she cared about, that adored her. And it was the same on the other side with the young boy, Tobias. He didn't believe he could ever have anyone. The angel taught him how to do it. So they go on the journey many days, many nights, and he teaches them all these lessons. And what he says is, she's plagued by the devil. I'm going to teach you how to get rid of the devil. And he tells them all, because of time, we're not going to get into the details right now. There's a wonderful book by Barbara Hannah called Jung's Lectures, where she talks about this. So one of the only Jungians that talk about the story of Tobit. It's a brilliant interpretation and translation she does of this tale. Anyway, they get there, and he falls in love with her. And a sidebar, I remember, it was about 15 years ago, I remember talking to a priest about a case I was working on, about a client that felt like Sarah and Tobias, that they would never have love. And this patient was really despairing. He said, you know what? I got a lot of good things in my life. Maybe this is not ever mine to have. And he told me this story. And I, when I heard it, I wept. It went so deep into my heart. And it's one of the reasons why I like to share this story. And in many ways, one seems to have to go to those dark nights of the soul when there's no hope, there's no even thought of the dawn. It's the negredo in alchemy. You go to the dark of the dark, to the bottom, and then something happens. And all of it, you know, when he gets to meet her, he talks to her, spends time with her, he begins to fall in love with her. And he says, man, you know, she had seven husbands die on the wedding night. And as he's telling he loves her and wants to plan their wedding, and she accepts his invitation, his proposal, you start hearing in the back, he said, the dig in my grave. And he looks out the window, and there are the grave diggers, smiling, number eight. You know? And he says, what am I going to do? The angel came in. Now, different from the story of Abraham and Isaac, Abraham used somebody else. This man is pledging his love to God, to self. The angel says, I taught you what to do. And he revealed, Raphael revealed, he wasn't just a guy that they hired. He was given from God to this man to help him with his life and to find this love. And they eventually, with all of the things and the things that they discovered and all, they got rid of the devil. So Tobias said, well, now I celebrate the marriage. And now we go close the lights and we go to our marriage bed. I said, no. And this part always also ripped me open. He says, you don't go to your bed right now. You both get together, kneel together, and you pray together to God. And I don't have the exact words, but basically what he says is, say to God that you are so thankful that you found what you thought you would never have in life. And thank God you had the strength to do what you had to do to make this happen. Don't ever take this for granted. You make your daily sacrifices and you give thanks every day for what you have. Every night before you go to bed, you have to do this. And they were blessed and they had a good life. And that story has such a different tone to it from all these false sacrifices, all these ways that we go about our false sacrifices. And, you know, if you think about it, how often do we get to the point in a day, in a week, in a year, and you ask yourself, what do I truly love? Hopefully we love our partner, our children. I mean, that hopefully goes without saying. But there's also another piece that everybody has a piece of destiny. La forza del destino. That you know you're brought into this world to bring something to fruition. Maybe for some it's your children, and that is wonderful, to be the best marital partner. That may be your piece of work. That may be your piece of clay that you work with your whole life. Other people have something else. It may be a piece of art that you do. And you know when you're doing that art, you're doing the work you're meant to do. Or the writing. And something happens when you say, you know what? I see I have 10 things in front of me that all are interesting to do right now. I could whittle down 5 of them, but 5 of these are really interesting. But what does the soul want you to do? And I think when we begin to really re-examine Abraham and we look at the story of Tobit and Tobias and Sarah, we begin to ask very different questions, which is, how do we bring this to fruition? What's asked of us? And I want to give a vignette to ground this and then a current event story. Some of you that are in part of our training program or graduates of our program know this story. I worked with a woman, and after about three sessions, I mean, it's a lot of details because of time, I'm just going to give the shortened version to capture the essence of this tale. I asked her, I said, what is it about you and kids? She said, why do you ask? I said, I'm not sure. And it was kind of one of those uncharacteristic moments as a therapist, you know, usually a little more disciplined about it, but I wasn't. I just said, what about you and kids? And she said, well, I'm leaving right now. See you next week. She left midway through the session, and I don't know if she's ever going to come back. And she came back. And she went on to tell me this very, very difficult story where she had her two daughters. She got married the first time, had her two kids, and then they got a divorce, and the kids are about 5 and 6 each, 5 and 7. And she got married a second time. She found a guy. She fell in love, right? And this guy was a jet setter. I mean, from the Switzerland to Italy to all over the world. And he said, you know, honey, we got a good life here. This is part of the honeymoon, right? We got a good life. We could live like this all the time. If only you ditch the kids. Give them back to the father. Get rid of them. You want me to give my children up? Yeah. Look at the life we got. You like this, right? Oh, I do like it. I like the cruises. I like the this. I like the that. I like, oh my God, the travel. Okay. And she gives up her children. At that point, whether you're a therapist, whether you're a coach, whatever your role is, there are moral mandates in life that we all have. And one of the mandates is to be an articulator like an angel of a field. Especially if you're a therapist, a pattern analyst, whatever, you need to say something. And I said, you slaughtered your children. You did something terrible to your kids. And yes, I'm sure as part of her past, I mean, she had a horrible past, suicide in the past, a father, and then on and on and on. And I said, yes, it's gone on from generation to generation, and now you have to carry this on your shoulders, what you've done. And to her credit, she didn't fight this. And she began to cry every session. Every session she cried and wailed. And after a while, I was hearing like two sets of cries, two sets of voices. I looked around. You ever hear that experience? Like somebody to do that bone density singing where it's like different voices coming from the same person? And I realized there were the cries of her daughters coming through her cries. And after about 2 years of this work, and it was relentless, well, just forgive and make it better and just repair all the... Oh, come on, please stop it. It's too simple. And you know, we've had many, many attempts in our lives to expiate our actions, expiate our guilt, expiate our transgressions. And actually, that's the next book I'm doing, The Transgression of Innate Moral Codes. We do many things to expiate it, from sin eaters to shamans to priests to confession to scapegoats and on and on. And again, to her credit, she wasn't looking for any scapegoats. She carried this. And, you know, I'm wondering, my God, how much is she going to be able to, can she carry this? Can she carry the reality that she gave her kids away? And she believed she was sacrificing them so she could have a better life. Guess what? Didn't God, and in my notes I have a number of pieces, and God rewarded Abraham, and God rewarded Jephthah, and God rewarded Abraham again when he sent his first kid to the wilderness. This is part of the paradigm we live with, and part of my thesis here is that this archetype, or the distortion of the archetype of sacrifice, is wired into our archetypal structure. Therefore, when we go about the work of bowing to the transcendent, when we go about the work of giving ourselves over to something greater, part of the instinct of that is there's going to be a predator that comes. There's going to be some act of predation that comes if we supplicate ourselves to something greater. And I realized as I went on with this, there are two levels to the death experience. One is in these stories is physical death. Isaac is going to be killed in the story. With Jacob and Esau, one is going to be killed or slaughtered or stolen from. How many stories in the Bible of slaughters, right? From Sodom and Gomorrah. Don't look away, because what's going to happen ain't pretty. Look away. It's justified. Look, I hate to say it. Bin Laden felt justified by what he did. We have to admit that. How many things are done in the name of God, say, well, this is right? My hero, St. Francis of Assisi, my beloved Assisi, the most beautiful place in the world for me, St. Francis was on his way to the Crusades to go kill and pillage and whatever until he was struck down. Then thus began the revelations that came to him, his new world and new life. This woman, she began after 2 or 3 years. I said, have you ever gone back to your kids and apologized? It's time. And it seemed as though the rumblings up above us. And it seemed as though there was a sense of timing about this, that she was now prepared to go back to them with no longer just unconscious guilt, but genuine remorse and regret. And say, I can't ask you to forgive. I can't ask you to take me back. I just want you to know in my heart of hearts, I have so much regret over what I did. And I don't even expect you to ever take me back as your mother and as a grandmother to these beautiful kids. Somehow, what happened? Mama, we love you. Slowly but surely, step by step by step, these kids took her back into their life. And I remember one day, maybe 4 years into this, 5 years into this process, she was having a Christmas dinner. She just bought a giant table, right? So everybody could fit around, the grandkids and the daughters and the husband. And I said, what are you doing? This guy's kidding around. I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I'm preparing for the dinner. I said, yeah, I know. Do you realize 3 years ago, 2 years ago, a year ago, you had no contact hardly with these kids? Now you got your grandkids coming to grandma's house? Get on your knees and thank God, man. She did the work. She did the sacrifice. She did all that she needed to do to make this transition and move into transcendence in her life. We're not taught this in the same way. It's not about just to suffer. She had to go through her own process, and suffering was part of it. But it's not about glorifying suffering. It's coming to grips with the reality. You want to take another part of this? Where is the unconscious guilt in the Abrahamic tradition? Where is that unconscious guilt that lives in the collective if we believe and continue to believe that we can make these so-called sacrifices of others? Where's the unconscious guilt in our militaristic systems when we believe we're making sacrifices? When I went to the graduation, the first 6 weeks of boot camp, they got a graduation. So we went out there and, you know, you see all these young kids. And I'm not trying to make a war statement. I'm really not going there. I'm trying to make another statement. You see these young kids, 300-400 of them, from 18 years old to 24-year-old men, a lot of young girls there. And they're all happy and excited. All of a sudden, it's as though all the illusion was gone. I forget what story was told by one of the commanding guys, right? All of a sudden, they realize, oh, my God, this is war. This is Afghanistan. This is nuclear war. And all of a sudden, all of the words, all of the sacrifices, all of the higher goals, it suddenly didn't mean that much when you realize we're being sent to this. This woman made what I think is a profound movement to transcendence because she carried the sacrifice on her own shoulders. The last story I want to give is, and some of you may know it, I don't know if it was Liberia, one of the countries where there was so many thousands of people that were being slaughtered by the warlords. And it was profit, it was rape for every reason imaginable. They were slaughtering everyone, and they were cutting limbs off to torture. I mean, just horrible stories. And the mothers and the women were just sitting around and sitting in mourning, not just sitting, but in mourning, not knowing what to do. Now, I was talking to my wife this morning, and she's a biblical scholar, and she was studying this, and she reminded me that this woman, Lama, had a dream. And the dream said, as in a number of these dreams of real transformation, it said, you have to do something with this. You have to do what you can to stop this. And she went door to door to door to door to door and said, would you come with us? Oh, my God, if we march, we're women. They're going to rape us. They're going to beat us. They're going to kill us. Will you come with us? Yeah. So you came. And then you came. And then you came. And then all of a sudden, what was a march of one woman became a march of thousands of women marching to the site where the warlords are having their meeting, planning out the next series of atrocities. This was a form of genocide. And the women were mobilized because of a dream. They said, we're not going to listen to you silly women. And then this one woman, Lama, however you pronounce Lama, realized, there's one thing I can do to stop these warlords. I am going to take my clothes off. And the warlord, as she began stripping in front of, they all look out the windows, and she began taking her clothes off. A big, beautiful Afro-American woman. And the men realized the greatest curse was to see a married woman naked. And all of a sudden, they were stopped. They were stopped in their tracks. The warlords that were planning the next massacre. And while they were stopped, story has it that all these men began to suddenly have a moment of conscience. And for some reason, at this moment, all these nameless, faceless slaughters suddenly became personal to these men. And he said, my God, this could have been my son and my daughter and my wife that could have been raped to have their arms and legs chopped off or their fingers chopped off. Or my son or daughter could have been raped here. It stopped. There was a moment of conscience. And part of the moment of conscience comes when one does that proverbial look into the mirror, into the reflecting pool, the reflecting pond, and ask, what is it that's being called of me in my life? And we at that moment, we abandon all the traditional traps that we have of all of our scapegoats and all of the ways we attempt to expiate our transgressions. And one does a proverbial, go off into the desert on their own, and they face their own, the sense of self, without having anybody to carry it. And I think it is a very important message for us to think about, again, how do we make this transition in our lives, and what are the Isaac sacrifices we've tried to make? So in closing, I want to play a little bit of a song here, okay? This is Leonard Cohen. Many of you remember Leonard Cohen from the Beat Generation. He's still around doing great stuff. And this is his song, it's the story of, or the song of Isaac.
The door, it opened slowly. My father, he came in. I was 9 years old. And he stood so tall above me. Blue eyes, they were shining, and his voice was very cold. Said, I've had a vision, and you know I'm strong and holy. I must do what I've been told. So we started up the mountain. I was running, he was walking, and his axe was made of gold. Well, the trees, they got much smaller. The lake, lady's mirror. We stopped to drink some wine. Then he threw the bottle over, broke a minute later, and he put his hand on mine. Thought I saw an eagle, but it might have been a vulture. I never could decide. Then my father built an altar. He looked once behind his shoulder. He knew I would not hide. You who build the altars now to sacrifice these children, you must not do it anymore. A scheme is not a vision, and you never have been tempted by a demon or a god. You who stand above them now, your hatchets blunt and bloody, you were not there before. When I lay upon a mountain and my father's hand was trembling with the beauty of the word. If you call me brother now, forgive me if I inquire, just according to who's planned. When it all comes down to dust, I will kill you if I must, I will help you if I can. When it all comes down to dust, I will help you if I must, I will kill you if I can. Mercy on our uniform, man of peace or man of war, the peacock spreads his fan.
Partly in answer, when I look at the story of this woman in Africa, I think about this woman and her children. I begin thinking, you know, maybe the women are right, the women's movement. When they say the power of the feminine, how much stuff do we have today? The power of the goddess, the power of the women. We have to redeem the feminine. And, you know, I know there's a lot of meaning in it, and I hear it gets a little overused a lot of times, but I'm beginning to think, you know what? Maybe it is the feminine that brings Eros into these stories that can change these tales. I mean, how many of the stories about kids going off to war, it's the mothers that come. Now, this may be a strange thing to say. I think women know more about sacrifice than men. In one way, just think of the thing about having a baby. And we had a group recently in Vermont. One person said, I didn't feel any pain having a baby. It was all wonderful. Drugs are good. Drugs are good. I mean, there's no way to get away from the fact that this is your body. You're going through this stuff that happens to you. I remember I almost fell asleep when my wife was getting ready to give birth to my son. It's like, it's a lot of hours, you know, and it's a lot of time, and it is some TV shows I'm on, you know. But what are you doing? I said, I'm sleeping. Guys, you know. But I think there's something built into it. Something that's built into the feminine psyche that I think is more innately connected to Eros than the masculine. And I'm not trying to say this to make it sound good or get the women's vote and all that kind of thing. I think there's something there. And again, when you look at these major stories of redemption, hopefully we can get to a point of a confluence, a consilience between the masculine and the feminine where the Eros is really going to come together here. And partly it's going to take some dismantling. And if nothing else, I hope this talk tonight has allowed you to even think about dismantling something of that story. And all of the suffering and the struggles and the this and the that. That's why I love what Wiesel says. The moment you go along with the idea of a suffering Christ and a suffering whatever, we justify it. We can go off and do the religious crusades. We can go off and do it and do the bombs and all this stuff. He said it takes a very different kind of psyche to do this work and to look at this differently, to ask, what is genuine sacrifice? So on that note, I really want to thank the Seattle group for putting this together kind of last minute and the wonderful turnout you got here tonight and to my friends I showed, to people I've known for many years, and to all of you. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.